Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure for me to be here and talk to you about the ideas that I work on. To start with, I think I want to tell you a little bit about like big questions that I'm interested in. When I started my PhD, I was always thinking, which direction to take and what the important original fundamental problems in physics are that I want to work on. And so I was like, we know 70% of the universe is dark energy and 30% is dark matter, so why not spending 70% of my time working on dark energy related ideas and 30% on dark matter related ideas? On the dark energy side, I'm interested in, how we can move back the evolution of the cosmic structures. Like going forward or going backward. If we know something about the initial condition, how we can model the nonlinear structure in the universe. And if we know we observe the structures, largest structures in the universe, how we can reconstruct the initial condition from that. And the other 30% of my interest, as Niyaj said, is about Milky Way streams, dwarf galaxies, and basically how can we quantify in a very big picture the out of equilibrium characteristic of the Milky Way. In this talk, I'm going to focus on the dark energy part and actually the reconstruction part. That if the big question is that if I give you the final snapshot of a simulation at redshift zero, let's say, how can we reconstruct the initial condition of that simulation just by having one single snapshot. So that's the big problem that you want to work on. From an observational point of view, for the first problem, we need to know the 3D information of the galaxies. We need to know the exact position, for example. And for the Milky Way science part, we need to know the 60. We want to know the phase space information of the stars in the Milky Way. So we need to, well, basically observationally, we need, I'm interested in the spectroscopic surveys. That's the part where DESI comes to the game. We need redshifts for galaxies for the first big question, and we need radial velocities for stars to have the 60 information of the stars. So that's how in my postdoc I tried move towards data and be a member of DESI. As you all probably heard about DESI is great. A few weeks ago, the year one results of DESI got published. The data will be publicly available, I think, by the end of the year. We all know that, DESI will be the largest 3D map of the universe this decade. It's going to observe around 40 million galaxies and quasars. Or a wide range of redshifts. But this is basically everybody knows about DESI, but one fact that might be new to some of you is that DESI also observes around 7 million of stars in the Milky Way. And that's the Milky Way Science Working Group of DESI. And it goes to very, like, we can observe highest halo stars very high up in the Milky Way plane. And so in DESI, I'm involved in both Milky Way science and also galaxy clustering. But again, in this talk, I'm going to focus on the galaxy clustering part and the reconstruction of the universe. Great. So to start with, or to just frame the problem, we can think of the initial condition that we have everything, all the particles are more or less on a grid. We have linear fluctuations. There are like overdense, underdense regions, but basically the position of particles is on a grid, but not a perfect grid. But the linear theory goes to the velocity or displacement of the particles in the initial condition. But the distribution is basically uniform. It's very smooth with the very tiny fluctuations in overdensity. If we name like one particle, the position of the particle q, it has a trajectory. I'm in a Lagrangian point of view, so I'm just following the trajectory of that particle. You can have a trajectory, it might have some orbits. We go to like multi-streaming regions or you know, shell crossing regions. But this is the final position, we can call it that x is a function of t. And if I just, you know, connect these two points with a vector, the displacement vector, I can say that the evolved position is the initial position plus displacement. And it's a very general and exact, and we don't want to do any approximation up to here. This is true for all the particles, basically. So I can say it's true for particle one, particle two, and for the pairwise distances between those particles, right? So from a data point of view, I can say this is the data that I observe, the evolved position, like the pair separation of the evolved position. What I'm interested in is actually the signal that I'm interested in is the initial condition pair separation. And the pairwise velocity is something like a noise that it's changing, you know, the position from the linear theory that we have to the nonlinear positions that we have. Basically, also nonlinear physics is very complicated. So we are interested in the linear physics. We want the signal that we are looking for is the initial condition that we have, basically. And that's how we want to think about the reconstruction.
I mean, so normally, you know, this Q is just the initial coordinate, like on a grid.
Right.
And the S is the signal. So yeah, so I'm just a little bit.
Yeah, so I just want to say that, for example, if we know Q, we want to get the Q. If we know the X, we want to get the Q, right? So that's why I'm trying to, we'll see in a second how I want to frame that. That's exactly why I say it's a very biased view of reconstruction. But so we know, like, simple, when we add two random variables, the probability of the data that we have is like the convolution. We can write it in this way.
Sorry. If that thing was that result. So I mean, if it's completely uniform, then it's not signal. But I mean, if it's a little bit away from uniform,
we do have the linear fluctuations there. Yeah.
You don't want to get completely uniform.
No. Just no.
A little bit linear.
Yes. Exactly.
Wait. What? So normally in LPT, Q is just the undisplaced initial position, which has no perturbations in it.
Right.
And then all the perturbations is in like this S field.
But if you're interested in linear theory,
then you want the S field as a function of Q.
S has nonlinear stuff in it, right?
I'll explain it in a second. Yeah. That's true. For example, when we want to generate the initial conditions, we want to say one LPT or two LPT, we're interested in the field, in the S field, if we want to move the particles from a perfect grid, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say in an initial condition of a simulation, the particles are already displaced
by the
S field, right? And I want to call that coordinates Q coordinates. For example, if I measure the power spectrum of that field, is the linear theory power spectrum, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, I can say the, like, from this convolution form of view, that the histogram of the pair separations today, the evolved position, is basically the initial pair separations of histogram, like histogram of the initial pair separations, convolved with the distribution of the pairwise displacements. Basically, all the cosmology is in the S displacement, as you said. It's this in this convolution kernel. But the initial condition pair separation is in the Q coordinates, in the Lagrangian coordinates of the particles that we have. Am I clear, making sense? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
Yeah, may I ask here also, because I'm getting a bit confused. So this S, do you think you mentioned, you assume it to be independent on Q or how?
It's a function of Q, right? It's a function of Q, right.
So that includes all nonlinear evolution.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's not really like noise.
No.
And it has the deterministic part.
No, definitely. Yeah. But when I want to think about, let me go a few steps further. But we can clearly see that. I want to say that, let's say if we have the two-point correlation function or a statistics of the nonlinear field, and I want to go to the statistics of the linear field, the reconstruction problem is like a deconvolution because of this displacement vector that we get with the particles, right?
But also nonlinear deconvolution, right?
It's a nonlinear deconvolution. Yes, exactly.
There's some spatially varying kernel.
Yes, spatial
deconvolution also just seems like a strange use of language.
It's
an inverse problem. Yeah.
It's a convoluted deconvolution.
Okay, and but a little bit about the physics, that why we are interested in the two-point correlation function of the field. I want to talk about the BAO physics. You know, in the early universe, we have a soup of protons, electrons, and photons. And there we know the pressure of the radiation of the photons is related to the, is proportional to the density, which means that if we have a density variation in photons, we have a pressure variation. And it means that over-dense in photons means over-pressured, and that makes a sound wave, it propagates through the gas. Or we can say photons drag baryons for 400,000 years with this speed, which is set by the amount of the full matter and baryonic matter. That gives us a specific scale. And, you know, universe at around redshift 1100 has cooled enough that hydrogen can stop being ionized. So photons can freely travel after that. And they're not, it's around that time, redshift 1100, that the photons and baryons are not coupled anymore. And that would leave the baryonic part of this sound wave at a specific scale, which we can, you know, expansion of the universe to go to the conformal coordinates, or expansion of the universe would put that 100 kiloparsec to around 100 megaparsec. That's what we expect to see right now. And we don't have one single peak in the density profile in the universe. We have several of them. Probably have seen these animations about the BAO. We have several of these rings. So around each peak, there's a ring with a specific radius that it's overdense, which is the region is more likely to have to form galaxies in those regions. And when we observe galaxies, actually, the galaxies are more likely to form around these overdense regions. It's a very exaggerated cartoon of BAO. But if we try to measure the statistics of the galaxies or the pair separation of the galaxies, we can see, we can detect the effect of these rings, actually, in the galactic surveys. And actually, I mean, if I want to give you more technical details, it's not just the histogram of the pair separations. It's relative to a random distribution. I want to define this two-point correlation function, which is like the pair separation of the data relative to the pair separation in the random field with the same geometry. And that's how we define the two-point correlation function. And if we do that in actual observations, we see this peak, which is called the BAO peak in the two-point correlation function. And that's the main reason we're interested in like this pair separation or two-pointed statistics or power spectrum is interesting to us for the BAO physics. And this is what DESI has observed. I'm not gonna go through this W not WA discussion of the DESI results, but for so many different, you know, tracers that we have, this is the BAO peak that's DESI has observed, and that's the peak that we just talked about, right? So the convolution I was talking about is that, for example, from the Zelovich approximation point of view, or 1LPT, we know that the evolved power spectrum is related to the initial power spectrum times an exponential term, right? E to the minus something, k squared. And since it's a multiplication in the Fourier space, it will give us a convolution in the correlation space, in the configuration space. And this is the kernel, the non-central chi distribution with the 3 degrees of freedom. I don't want to go through the details of that, but it comes from the Zelovich approximation, basically, the first order Lagrangian perturbation theory. And we can connect the linear power spectrum to the linear correlation function, the nonlinear correlation function. And all the cosmology and everything is in the smoothing scale of that kernel. It's in the, that comes from displacement, basically. And so the problem is that, for example, here, the black line is the linear correlation function. And as we go to the nonlinear field, we see this convolved or a smeared effect. And the main point of reconstruction is that when we observe the nonlinear correlation function, how can we move it back to the sharper one? How can we sharpen the correlation function of the field? And basically, the reason that we're interested in is that, you know, the scale of the peak would change around like a 5 megaparsec. And the main point of reconstruction is like moving the scale of the peak back to the linear theory, where we can constrain our cosmology. Is it clear everything? Is there any question on that? So a simple reconstruction, which is the reconstruction of the two-point correlation function, not the reconstruction of the full field, is that we can assume that the linear theory can be written as a simple polynomial over this specific range, over, for example, let's say from 75 megaparsec to 110 or 60 to 120. Around the BAO peak, people have shown that we can have a good fit if we assume the linear correlation function is just a simple polynomial, right? If we assume that, just based on this convolution, the nonlinear correlation function can be written as a sum over the moments of this kernel, basically, right? We have like the r to the power of 1, 2, 3, right, up to the whatever n we want to write our simple polynomial. And the nonlinear correlation function would be the sum over these basis functions, or the moments of that kernel. These are like log-R polynomials. It's just the moments of this non-central chi distribution. And so, we can add mode coupling. We can take care of some details in the perturbation theory for writing this form. There might be like an additive term to this convolution. But the reconstruction algorithm that's proposed is that if we do this fit to nonlinear data, we can get the fitting parameters of this with these basis functions, with some priors on the sigma in the kernel. That's where cosmology goes to, actually. And we can connect these CKs to these AKs, and we can try to reconstruct the linear correlation function. Like, we have the nonlinear correlation function, we fit these weird functions to the nonlinear measurements. We find the fitting coefficients, we convert the fitting coefficients to the simple polynomial coefficients, and we can reconstruct the linear theory. It's like, this is a test we did in Kyoto simulations. The black dots with error bars, they are correlation function of redshift 0. And the black solid curve is the linear theory correlation function. We fit our log-R functions to these black dots, and by just converting the fitting coefficients, we can reconstruct the red curve, which is some sort of, you know, that's why I mentioned deconvolution, in terms of when we fit something to the smeared correlation function, we want to go back to the sharper correlation function, which is the linear theory correlation.
Yes, I have a question here. So this chi distribution, where does it come from?
It's, if you write nonlinear power spectrum from the Zelovich approximation, something like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we know sigma squared is like an integral over power spectrum, basically. That's where cosmology goes to. If you do a Fourier transform.
I'm just going to do something.
Oh, sure. Oh, perfect, thanks.
Did I cover that?
Okay. No, you're good.
No, it's fine.
Nice. Okay.
It's fine. Just the Fourier transform of this thing, if you want to go from power spectrum to correlation function, the Fourier transform, the 3D Fourier transform of a Gaussian term would be the non-central chi distribution.
Okay.
in configuration space.
With some ansatz for the linear parse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What ansatz are you using here?
I mean, here we are assuming, and we are assuming that we can write the linear power spectrum over the BAO range with a simple polynomial, so like the model-free assumption of that. I mean, the main reason of doing this reconstruction is being like template-free reconstruction. We don't want to assume any templates about the linear theory correlation function. We just want to assume that the linear theory correlation function can be written as a simple polynomial, and then try to fit the nonlinear correlation function and reconstruct the linear correlation function.
Right. So sigma, you take it as a fitting parameter, or you really compute?
Well, okay, so that's exactly, Navia is a PhD student at Yale. For all these tests, all these papers I've written, I assume just the value of sigma. We can have a fiducial value, and we did some robustness test that, you know, if we change the value of sigma around the correct value, what would be the effect on the fit? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty robust. But yeah, in general, we can assume that sigma is also nonlinear. It's like a fitting parameter. It's like in that case, it would be a nonlinear regression that we want to do. It's not linear in new functions. We would have a sigma dependence too. I mean, the main idea that I work on with Navian is that with just the nonlinear regression, can we constrain sigma as a free parameter or not? Mm-hmm. When we want to just fit to the nonlinear correlation function from measurements.
Mm-hmm. I'm just puzzled by the expression you wrote down. Sorry. I mean, so you've written the nonlinear power spectrum as something damped times the linear power spectrum.
Yes.
Right. I mean, but the actual nonlinear power spectrum is typically larger than the linear power spectrum.
Large. Okay, so this is what.
So nonlinear structure.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. I totally understand your question. So basically, when we have nonlinear correlation function, we see something like this, right? I mean, nonlinear correlation function is probably something like this, right? And when we damped it, I agree that you think that it goes below the linear. If let's say it's linear, it's nonlinear, and this is the damped, right? That's totally true. It comes from the Zeldovich approximation, right? This form of the connecting the nonlinear to linear, which is not true below some scale where we have, for example, shell crossing. Basically, Zeldovich assumes that everything like moves on a straight lines, right? But around the BA, like for BAO feature, this damp gives us this form of a smearing in the correlation function.
But even on the BAO scale, it looks like the sign is wrong because it decreases the power, doesn't it?
It does. It does decrease, right?
You're saying at the BAO scale, the power is decreased. By
and that's what we see in this, like the smearing feature that we see in the correlation function.
Yeah, normally this should be applied to oscillatory part only, not of the power spectrum, but not to the broadband.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is just Zeldovich approach.
This is just Zeldovich. I think that the best paper I remember read, it's like Taylor Hamilton 96, I think. But pure Zeldovich, if you measure the correlation, like power spectrum of the Zeldovich approximation, you can see it's something like that. I agree that this might be a bit puzzling since it's like a damping and it moves the linear correlation function lower. But we know in nonlinear field we get more power on smaller scales, but this is only true on larger scales, basically, because we know Zeldovich is not a good approximation on a smaller scales because of the shell crossing and multi-streaming regions. So that was just reconstruction of the statistics of the field, but another question, which is again related to this big reconstruction problem. But the question is that how we can reconstruct the full field, not only the two-pointed statistics of the field, right? What if we want to, here is just, we work with the statistics, like the two-point correlation function of a nonlinear field, and we want to move it back to the two-point correlation function of the linear field. But how can we reconstruct the full field if I just want to move the particles back to their initial position? The idea is that if I know the x coordinates, I want to move everything back to q coordinates. I don't want to integrate back. There's a subtlety here. I don't want to integrate back the trajectory. I don't care what the exact trajectory of each particle is. I just want to find the vector field that it moves back that particle to the q coordinates. So the idea that I worked on the last year of my PhD and basically over the past 2 years, my postdoc is related to this optimal transport theory. It's a very French problem. The problem in mathematics field is it's a 200-year-old problem. And the problem is that if you know the location of some bakeries in Paris, and you also know the location of some cafes in Paris, what's the optimal way of distributing croissants from bakeries to cafes, right? So that's the pure math problem. And over 200 years, so many people have tried to, you know, to develop like mathematical framework, or even more recently, very fancy computational algorithms. Because, for example, it's also related to Amazon delivery. You have some locations that you want a delivery package, and you know what's the optimal way of that routing problem, right? In the physics language, okay. So this is the OT question: that how to map a distribution into another while we're preserving weights and minimizing the effort. So here, the weights that are like we want to have the, you know, the number of croissants be equal from bakeries to cafes. We want that the production and consumption be similar. It's like a mass conservation of the croissants between bakeries and cafes. But in physics, the way that we can see that, we can say the optimal transport, it's a very, I think, well physics motivated mathematical framework. We can see it's the, like a minimum action principle subject to the mass conservation, some conservation law. So how I formulated this math framework in the cosmological context is, it's actually not a very new idea. People proposed this type of idea over like 20 years. The first papers that related to these types of things were like 2002, 2003. And so the idea is that, let's say we know the position of some particles that are clustered and are not uniform at all, right? The red dots there, and we put all the blue dots on a perfect grid, right? What's the optimal way that I can map the red dots to blue dots in a way that I minimize the displacement of the total displacements of the particles, right? In a more mathematical way, we know mass conservation, we can write mass conservation in this way, and if I assume, it's an assumption that we can talk more about. If I assume that the q coordinates can be related to the x coordinates with a gradient flow, and it means, okay, again, it's not true when we have shell crossing, or it's not true when particles have orbits, right? Because the gradient flow doesn't have any crossing, basically. I can write the mass conservation in this form. It's just that equation, we write it as a determinant of the Jacobian. And it gives us the determinant of this Hessian, which is the Hessian of this potential that we have here. It's the function of x. This is a theorem that connects basically this assignment problem, optimal transfer problem, to the mass conservation problem or reconstruction problem that we have in cosmology. And it says that, you know, solving the Monge-Ampère equation, and this equation is called Monge-Ampère equation in mathematics, basically. It's a nonlinear equation, partial differential equation. And this theorem by Jambrenier showed that, you know, solving the Monge-Ampère equation, the solution to this equation, is equivalent to the solution of this assignment problem with a quadratic cost function. A quadratic cost function is like the distance that we want to define between any of these particles should be in a quadratic form, like a kinetic form, like x minus q squared, just like a velocity form. But basically...
Sorry to interrupt, I'm just curious. I assume the Ampere is the same one that...
It's the same Ampere. Yes, exactly. Yes. But so, I mean, the reason that people didn't work on this reconstruction problem is that it's computationally, it's very expensive. Basically, if you want to find this optimal assignment between these objects, the best algorithm that exists in this discrete form, the complexity of the algorithm is like n squared log n. So basically, we cannot run that in any cosmological simulations. But what I was trying to do is just during my PhD, I was playing with this type of assignment problem. And I was thinking about the resolution that we have in these grid forms that we have in our simulation. What if we want to run it on a like much higher resolution? Or what if we have a very finer grid with these blue dots? And the idea started from the fact that we can, instead of one-to-one map, we can do one-to-four map, right? Or 1 to 8, 1 to 16, 32. It's like the same number of blue dots are mapped to each red point, right? So we still have that mass conservation, but it's just I'm using the finer grids for my target distribution, right? And as we go on, we see there are some cells or there are some patterns in these shapes. And first I thought it might be something like a Voronoi tessellation in this space, but I visited some people like French mathematicians and computer science, and I realized it's not actually Voronoi, it's a modified Voronoi tessellation, which is called Laguerre tessellation or power diagram. And it's the modification to Voronoi tessellation is that it's Voronoi tessellation with this condition that each cell should have the same area. Because to each red point, we are mapping the same number of blue dots. The area of each cell that we have, each tile that we have here, should be equal to each other.
Area or volume?
Well, in 2D area, in 3D volume, basically. Yeah. This is like a 2D cartoon I was showing. So basically, what I did was writing this algorithm in 3D, and this is what we can get. It's like if we start from, redshift 0 of a simulation, we have some halos with their masses, we have with some other particles, like dark matter particles that are not inside the halos, right? We can try to make this modified Voronoi tessellation with this condition that the volume of each cell should be related to the mass of that object. For example, if we have a very massive halo here, we want to assign a very large cell to that specific halo. And if we have, like for the dark matter particles that are not inside the halos, like a field particles, we have very small cells in between.
Yeah, my mask here. So it looks to me like you're assigning the cell around the position of the galaxy, at zero. Is it right thing to do? Because we know there are a lot about flows that actually transport.
Oh, okay.
From somewhere.
Yes.
And that's what you want to undo it.
Exactly. So, but okay. So let's see one thing more. It's like a 3D object that I made a 3D print of this shape. It's nothing important. But okay. So.
Is that you doing? Like,
yeah, that was me.
I
okay. So I made a 3D print of that shape. And these are like when you want to make a 3D print is like you need to have all these line supports and you need to cut them. But that's a 3D form of that figure we have. It was interesting. I did it at there is an Engineering Innovation and Design Center at Yale. And 3D print is really cool.
That's Notre Dame, right?
Sorry?
Notre Dame, is it?
it's like a Borg cube in Star Wars. But yeah. But so this is the dynamic. This is very related to the question you asked. This is the dynamic that we have. When we do this tessellation, this Laguerre tessellation, first there are some conditions that for example, the particle can be the center can be outside of the cell that it's assigned to, right? So it can capture two physical behaviors. One is the collapse of the object, and then is the movement of the object. So for example, when we assign this single point to this area of the space, to this patch, the center of mass of the patch has been displaced. So like the movement of the center, let's say we go from proto-halos to halos, right? We have one collapse, there is a physics of the collapsing, and there is a physics of movement of the center of mass of the proto-halo to the actual halo, right? So that's what we can.
Yeah, well, how does it work? No, I don't understand. How does it happen that this cell is assigned to this point? It looked to me like you minimize the distances. Right?
Yeah, it's just, okay, so the way that you want to assign these cells is that, it helps if we look at this. For example, let's say for k-means clustering, right, when you want to do Voronoi. What we have some centroids that are fixed, and you can look at this as like we expand these circles around each centroid, right, and they stop when they touch each other, right? This is a simple Voronoi tessellation. Since it's a, here, it's for a Euclidean distance. So since it's a Euclidean distance, we can think about it as a cone, right? If we have the quadratic distance, it would be a parabolic surface around that, right? So this expansion of the circle is like expanding the cones, right? But there might be, if I want to put this extra condition that each cell have the similar area or the same area. For example, here the yellow one has a very small area, but the other ones are larger. One free parameter that I have is like fine-tuning the heights of each of these cones. If I move one cone up and down, I can adjust, I can rearrange them in a way that each of them has the same area, right? And that's the optimization problem that I solve. It's like I do Voronoi tessellation, and I optimize the heights of these cones so that, for example, if they have the same volume or same area with the prescribed mass that we have in our halo catalog. So if we have a more massive halo, I want to move the height of that cone so that it has larger volume. I want to assign larger volume to that specific object. If we have a less massive halo, I want to assign a smaller volume to that object.
So somehow in the optimization, you're adjusting it to match the halo mass.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
But there is no assumption. We know them. We need to know. It's like model independent in a way that we only need to know the mass of every single object. We need to have an estimate of the mass, but we don't need to know the form of the mass halo mass function, right?
But you know, like not all the masses are in the halos, right?
Right. Yeah. So we do that exactly for the field particles that are also outside of the halos, and so we have a very small cell for those particles.
But I mean,
in general, right, if we want to move to data at the end, we don't know the distribution of the particles that are not inside the halos, and we need to make some assumptions about those field particles. And that's where probably cosmological assumptions
come. Go back to your action, I guess. I'm just
here?
Yeah, so I guess, is that the action that you're up to?
Yeah, that's the partitioning optimization that I do. I want to find the Q. It's like the region of each cell, given that, you know, the kinetic term that we have here is something like the x minus q squared, the displacement squared, and the potential that we have is related to the height of these cones that I showed.
So this is not the actual
it's not the actual action. No, it's not the actual action gravity. Yeah, I mean, that's what I mentioned, that, for example, we don't want to if we do actual action minimization, we move back on the actual trajectory. It's like the, you know, orbit integration backward. But here, I just want to find that map, that straight gradient map to move position x to position q.
Right. Are you going to talk about if you look at real n-body simulation?
Exactly. Yes. So this is the program that, this is the code that we have with Bruno. Bruno Levy is a computational, he's from computer science department, but he's a computational physicist. This is what we did, and it won like a award in one of these computer science conferences, which is a big, I don't know about the details of these conferences, but this is the video that we have. So this is, for example, the displacement vector field that we can reconstruct to move one particle, like each of these cells, to the actual halo that we started. It's like a slice, 2D slice of the dark matter simulation, and these are the displacement vectors that we get. And the surface that we have here is like the potential, so that the perpendicular, the gradient of that potential would give us this displacement map. Great. So let's look at the actual n-body simulations. This is a one single halo that we have in Kyoto simulation. The cross is the center of mass, and the blue dots are the particles in that halo, So I can just look at the same particles in the initial condition, and these are the black dots are the exact same particles. Like, we have the ID of each particle. We can go to the initial condition of the simulation and we see where they are, right? So the black dots are the exact same particles in the initial condition of that simulation. So again, we see they are more or less unagreed. They're not perfectly unagreed because of the initial condition displacements, but they are more or less unagreed. And the cross, the purple cross, is the center of mass of the black dots, the center of mass of the protohalo. So we call this patch of the black dots like the protohalo, and the blue dots are actual halo, right? And this is the cell that we get from the reconstruction. This is a cell which is assigned to this specific halo. And we see first the center of the baryon in the geometrical center of this cell is very close to the actual center of mass of the protohalos. And the shape also is somehow similar. So what I did, what I've done so far.
This is from an n-body simulation?
This is from an n-body simulation. Yeah.
So the dots are from the actual n-body, and then the polygon is from your reconstruction.
Yes, yeah. The dots is actual, like the same particles in the initial condition of that simulation. Oops, sorry.
In this simulation, there were more particles, I understand, or not, I mean, around, or just a single halo?
No, the
from big small, bigger small.
Yeah, it's one single halo from a big
simulation.
Yeah, it's a full cosmological simulation, 1 gigaparsec cubic box. I just focus on one single halo of that thing. And the reason that you see probably there are less black dots than blue dots is just because it's a projection. On the z direction, they're all on top of each other.
Right. Probably I just don't understand how from your optimization it comes out that all the particles that you find or all the cells is on one side of the point.
Okay, so
there is nothing on the other sides.
Yeah, this is one single cell, and these polygons that you see here are just the faces that we have in that cell.
Yeah, but it's all on one side from the halo, right?
There's some other halos.
There are some other halos, and there are other.
They push out.
Yeah. I mean, basically for doing the reconstruction, I didn't run that reconstruction for that single halo. We reconstruct the full field, but we are just looking at one single halo. So the reason that, you know, this single cell is assigned to this halo is because, you know, we see the environment. There are some other particles around it. There are some other halos around this halo. And that's why we see this off-center. Like, I mean, we can see the movement of the actual halo.
There are much bigger halos that... Because, yeah, my question is why there are nanoparticles, you know, on the lower right corner assigned to this halo, and the answer is what? There are much bigger halos up there that kind of push
them. Exactly. They attracted all the other particles probably. Yeah.
And the cells go through each other?
Sorry, cells here?
Like if I take another halo, there would be another cell?
Yeah. It's like this.
They wouldn't overlap. They are...
There is no overlap between the cells, but yeah, if you look at this thing here, so we have different cells, and each of these cells have some neighboring cells, right? So, you know, we have so many small cells that are for the particles that are not inside the halos. And so for big halos, you see they don't have overlap, but they have neighboring cells. And that's how we define these faces of these cells that we can reconstruct, actually.
But there are like some points in the cell, like neighboring cell that come to the halo in the other cell.
Yeah. So maybe I can, okay, again here, there is no guarantee that the centroid or the single halo should be inside the cell that we find. As I said, for example, I don't know, this is a cell that we have, and so all the particles that are in this cell would finally end up somewhere which is outside of the cell. But we want to assume, for example, for this particle, we're assigning this cell that is here, right? In k-means clustering, or for simple Voronoi tessellation, all the centroids should be inside the cell that we find. But because of that optimization, we might have some cells that are outside of. If I want to give you a better geometrical point of view, is that it actually comes from the fact the cost function is quadratic. So like, let's say we have two halos in 1D. One of them is much more massive than the other. So in quadratic form, these are the probable surfaces that we have for that tessellation. If I move it up, it comes here. This would be the tessellation that we have. So this area is now assigned to this halo, which is outside of that specific halo, right?
Yeah, so you showed us an example for a fairly massive cluster-sized halo. Do you have other examples for smaller halos?
Yes. So, okay, what I did is like, here it was one example, but what we can do is just basically measuring the correlation function of the center of mass of the protohalos and the barycenter of these cells, right? I mean, in the same way that we have halos, we have the center of mass of the halos, we can measure the correlation function of the halos, right? I can, even without any reconstruction or anything, I can look at the protohalos in a simulation, find the Lagrangian volume of each halo, find the center of mass of those things. They are clustered, right? And we can measure the correlation function of that. That's the purple curve that we have here. These are the protohalos. And basically, they are sharper than even linear theory. The BAO peak is sharper in protohalos than linear theory. And the green curve is what we get from the barycenter of each of these cells, if we measure the correlation function of the barycenters of each of these cells. And only for halos. We don't care about the field particles that are not inside the halos. We do reconstruction for everything, but we keep only halos, the cells that are related for halos, associated to halos. And if I want to, okay, the dashed line that we have here, that you see it's sharper than even linear theory, it just comes from the fact that, you know, Lagrangian bias and Eulerian bias are related to each other with b minus 1. So I'm just scaling these curves by b over b minus 1 squared to have the same Eulerian bias amplitude.
Sorry, maybe you said it how do you get the band around the mean value?
The error bars? Yeah, the error band. It's like we do this reconstruction for 20 different realizations. And that just the mean and error bar around that.
Yeah, okay, sorry, I think you said, but I didn't maybe follow. So, okay, so like the thick curves versus the thin curves, or what?
So first just think about the thick curves, right? They are just the correlation function of the protohalos, and I'm comparing that with the OT reconstructed ones. It's like if I measure the correlation function of the green crosses and purple crosses, right? And they are perfectly on top of each other around the BAO peak. It's not true below, let's say, 15 megaparsec, but around the BAO peak, they are perfectly on top of each other. So for the dashed lines, I'm just showing that, you know, in protohalos, actually, the BAO peak is sharper than in the linear theory and obviously on the nonlinear theory. So before we had that from linear theory to nonlinear field, like the Eulerian field. We see the Eulerian one is smeared than the linear theory. But the protohalos are actually sharper than linear theory curve. It helps, you know, when we want to detect the BAO peak. What I'm just saying is that if we go to if we try to reconstruct the protohalo field, not the full linear field, we get a sharper BAO peak in that field.
So what's fun is the bond match. I still didn't get it. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. So like so these thin curves you're saying is like the thin curves are just the thick curves but multiplied by some number.
Yeah. Yeah. And the numbers is just the Eulerian bias divided by b minus one Eulerian bias.
So I don't understand how you can multiply a curve by a number and then change the shape.
It doesn't. Why not? I mean. It's like, okay, so what I'm saying is that we know that let's just talk about the protohalo. We know for halos, it's like b squared linear correlation function, right? It's the Eulerian bias, right?
Okay.
And so for protohalos, we can write it as b minus 1 linear bias, right?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, like, but you're saying that these thin curves are more peaked than the thick curves. Is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying that when we just I'm just saying that if you multiply the thick curves by
a number,
They are sharper than the Eulerian curve. Yes.
But they don't have the same shape. They look different. They cross zero at different places.
Okay. No, I mean they are like the zero crossing points are fixed basically.
Okay, maybe they are the same. So what sense is it sharper if you're just multiplying by a number? I mean,
We are not sharpening by multiplying by the number. Right? You're just fixing the amplitude to be able to compare those curves with each other.
You're comparing it with the yellow band.
Yeah, I'm just...
the overall bias of the Eulerian sample, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, then the argument is that the BAO peak is sharper than it is in the Eulerian case.
Oh, okay, so you're saying that I'm comparing the thin curves to the yellow.
Yellow and actually the linear theory, the black dot curve that is here, right? I'm just fixing the amplitude of these two thick curves to the yellow one, to the halo and linear theory one, to show that they are sharper. I mean, sharpening is not coming from multiplication. I'm just fixing the amplitude to be able to compare these curves with each other.
Yeah, so how do we assess the the systematics that can be introduced here on the position on the peak as well, just from simulations?
Well, it's from simulations, the plot I'm showing you, but from the peaks theory calculations, we have this idea that, for example, I mean, the fact that proto-halos are sharper from the peaks theory calculation that we can show it comes from the K-squared bias term that we have in the proto-halos. It's like in the initial condition field, if we try to find the peaks?
Yeah. No, what I'm asking, I mean, in this procedure, so basically we'll be reconstructing the DBO from this kind of tessellation procedure, may introduce some bias or some systematics, or may not, I don't know, but yeah, how would you assess that?
Yeah, it comes from the fact that when we want to apply this algorithm to data, we don't know the distribution of the particles that are not inside the halos.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And the mass estimation of the halos, that's another thing. So basically, okay, so let me, I think I have like three minutes.
Yeah, but even for n-body, have you shown that there is no kind of systematic offset?
Yeah, we checked that, you know, that what exactly Sasha did. Sasha is another PhD student at Yale. It's like when we do actual fitting. So in my paper, I just showed that by eyes, they are close to each other, right? But so what Sasha is working on, and the paper should be out soon, is like when we do the proper fitting to these curves, there is no shift of the BAO compared to the linear theory that we have and compared to the proto-halo prediction that we have.
So is there understanding of that beyond this experimental kind of verification? Is it this theorem that you mentioned before? Does it guarantee that?
Yeah, it does. It's like there are some other issues when we want to move towards data, for example, retrograde space distortion or modeling the particles that are not inside the halos. But yes, it shows robustness to those tests too.
I just want to check the spread around the yellow and the pink curves for the halo and proto-halo, are those from multiple different simulations?
Yes, it's like 20 different realizations that we have. It's the one sigma error bar. The
spread is from 20 different reconstructions.
Yes, exactly, of their single box. Good, so let's move forward. I just want to show that, probably I can skip these things. It's like the cross correlation. Okay, so we have different fields. We have the true displacement vector field that we have we can have basically for every single particle in the simulation. We have the OT reconstructed vector field. We have the Zelovich displacement vector field. So we can try to measure the cross correlation between any of these things, and theta is like the divergence of these fields.
What was OT again? Sorry.
So OT is like the reconstructed display. So we have the x coordinates. We find the barycenter of each cell. So we have the q coordinates for
so
that.
OT is your thing.
Yeah.
Oh, optimal transport.
Oh, sorry, optimal transport reconstruction. Yes. Yeah, there's a comparison with the standard reconstruction. This is for the power spectrum plot, the Weigel part of the power spectrum. So this MAK is Monge Ampere Kantorovich, or this optimal transport reconstruction, the blue lines. And the LiDAR lines are a standard reconstruction.
Which is just Zeldovich?
Which is just Zeldovich, yes. The initial condition is the solid dashed black curves, and the nonlinear field is this smeared ones, and it's just the comparison to show, you know, how much it works better compared to the standard reconstruction, and that's.
Okay, wait, sorry. Yeah, like so, in your left panel, you have this orange curve at, R equals one everywhere, and the orange is your thing cross Zeldovich.
No. Okay. So. This is, which is, over one is the pink one, is like the initial condition and divergence of the Zeldovich. We expect it to be one, which is perfect.
Oh.
What we have, it's the true displacement, the divergence of the true displacements and OT displacement, which is the blue curve, which is what we have, and the true displacements. The orange and green are on top of each other. They are true displacement with Zeldovich displacement and true displacement with the initial condition. We expected that because initial condition is, I mean, we know the divergence of the Zeldovich displacement is actually the initial density field. And the optimal transport divergence and the initial condition, like the purple and yellow curve, are again on top of each other here. What we are saying is that if we want to reconstruct the true displacement, what we are getting is it's much closer to the true displacement. But if we want to compare it with the initial density, because the divergence of the true displacement is not actually the initial condition density field, we get something which is lower. And so the idea is that if we want to constrain our cosmology with the initial density field or the theta field, the divergence of the displacement field that we have. Right.
So what? On the net, which RFK is the one with the standard reconstruction?
Oh, so on the left there's no standard reconstruction, but basically it should be very close to the Zeldovich displacements.
But the Zeldovich is orange. I guess there are two. Are there two oranges? Okay.
There's one. So the color. There's.
What is the one that's the highest one?
This is just the initial condition and the Zeldovich displacement. We expected it to be one over all the scales, right?
About shell crossing.
Exactly. I mean, the main reason that we cannot reconstruct below some regions is that we assume that this optimal transport map is a gradient flow, right? So gradient flow means that it doesn't see any shell crossing, so we cannot go below those scales. But when we work with bias tracers, something gets kind of better, and is that okay, if I work with actual dark matter particles, shell crossing is a big important thing, right? If I average all the particles like over the region of the protohalo and just work with the center of mass of the protohalo's two halos, that curve, I mean, we don't have much shell crossing actually there. It's a simpler case in terms of modeling shell crossing. But so here, what I'm just showing is that, you know, the initial condition power spectrum is that, and this divergence of the displacement field is the purple one that we get. It's kind of related to truncated Zeldovich approximation. We have kind of showed that this optimal transport map can be related to truncated Zeldovich approximation. And so I don't have time. Let me see. There is redshift space effect. Oops. That we showed that optimal transport works okay until the range of 25, 30 megaparsec, and below that we cannot remove all the anisotropic feature that we have from redshift space distortion. And in terms of DESI right now, I'll be applying this reconstruction method to the bright galaxy sample of the DESI, which is about 15 million galaxies. And I think the result for that should be out very soon. I can skip that. So there are okay, with what else we can do from this reconstructed displacement field? One is just comparing that with peculiar velocity surveys. We have the displacement of every single galaxy. We can compare that to the actual peculiar velocity that they have. And we know from linear theory that the velocities and displacements are related with F. So it might be a way to reconstruct the growth rate of the structures. This is the preliminary result that we have, in a way that if we know the actual velocity of the halos and the displacement that we get for that specific halo, by some assumption for H naught, we can concentrate F. Another direction that we are thinking about is the KSZ effect, that, again, we know that the KSZ signal is related to the tau and the halo velocity. So we can approximate the halo velocity with this displacement vector fields and talk about the baryonic feedback, the tau that we have. And another thing is like running, if we know that potential field, we can just do exact straight line evolution simulations. It's like we know the Lovich potential is physically correct, but when we run a simulation on a straight line, it moves us to a wrong position. But if we have a wrong initial potential, which its gradient would move us back to the exact final position, we can just do a straight line simulations with that physically wrong potential. And so the problem is that how we can find that the potential in the initial condition where its gradient would move us back to the exact final position of the particles. And yeah, that's basically it. Just a summary, DESI is interesting, and reconstruction is also interesting, and optimal transport is not just a computational tool, it has some physical interpretation that can be applied to any form of, if you have an action minimization with a mass conservation, you can think of it as in this optimal transport framework.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, kind of trying to understand the following thing. So it looks like you didn't use anything from gravity or from dynamics of gravity,
No. Just
mass conservation. But then, for example, I can have potential flows in incompressible fluids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there, particles don't kind of gather. I mean, it's completely different dynamics.
It's mass is conserved, but it's not. I don't think it's incompressible.
Yeah. Maybe with high sound speed, right? Where kind of it's hard to compress things, right? Yeah. So here, kind of compressibility is 100%, right? Everything compresses to a halo, right? Whereas I can imagine a situation where I have potential flows and they don't compress, right? Because of pressure and. It looks like the method will still work in some sense, but that's puzzling to me, how it can capture these very different dynamics. So do you have understanding of that?
The main thing that we... We can say with this, gradient flow that we have is that it does not capture the true trajectories. As I said, we are not getting this black trajectory back by doing this optimization problem. But we can kind of do this assignment, which is not perfectly true. I mean, it might be a bit off, but statistically, when we measured, for example, the two-point statistic of the reconstructed field on very larger scales, it works very well. So that's the point. If the science is about smaller scale science, if you want to get, for example, the actual position of every single galaxy, like the proto-galaxy or proto-halo, It's not going to work probably below some scales. But for larger scale science, like BAO science or those types of things, it works very well.
Are there questions? Okay, no question online. Okay, so I think that's it. Let's thank
Thanks.
Again.
Thank you.